Okay. Can you hear me okay? Am I on? No? Okay. I'm happy to speak up. I just know that they want to record us or something. I don't know, you know. So I am recording this. Oh, this is all right. But the rest of you guys can hear me? Okay. So this is great because I don't like to stand behind a podium. So, I've worked with Dave Wilcox for about 22 years, and he really, any of you that know Dave Wilcox, you knew as soon as he came in, I was not him. But he has a son that has been in a coma for last month, and I'll say a little bit more about that at the end. I think we can pray for him. But this is some work that he's doing through a BioLogos grant. He's working on a manuscript about a Christian perspective on human evolution. I've had the privilege to read some preliminary chapters. It's very good. All right, so evolving toward the fall, a model of neuroplasticity and original sin. So the goals of this talk are going to be to review recent advances in science regarding human evolution, review theological models of the fall and human sin, and propose a model of the origin of human sin to reconcile biblical theology and scientific data. All this in 30 minutes. All right, the assumption behind all of this work is the classic two books approach, that God is the inspirer of the Bible and the author of creation, same author. Okay, so you know, whatever the conflicts we see at the level of the creator, they ultimately have to line up. And of course, there's Galileo, who has argued that position with the Catholic Church and didn't win. So all our theories and doctrines are the best explanations that we can make concerning the data. So how, and specifically in this case, you know, how do we look at Adam and Eve and the origin of sin? Here's Michelangelo's famous painting from the Sistine Chapel. So is Adam literal, or is Genesis 1 through 4 meant to be some sort of a metaphorical description? Is it poetic in some way? Is it archetypical? Is it federal? Adam is the representative. There are various theological approaches that have been taken. And at the same time, there is a great deal of ferment in the field of human evolution. There are new things discovered continually, especially now that we're able to do DNA and RNA analysis. And in fact, David says, you know, this is the situation that he lives with. My colleague Ben Dubé, also from our biology department, he and I were joking about this. David is one of the most amazing people I have ever known for his ability to just keep up with the literature. He just devours journals and truly keeps up as best he can ahead of the avalanche of the rapidly changing field of human evolution. There's just constantly new ideas and new findings coming into the field. All right, so the dilemma, if God made the world good, why are we unhappy sinners in need of human revelation, or redemption, excuse me? And so the theological debate is the origin of original sin. Is sin all due to Adam's guilt being legally imputed to us, or is it due to our own act of sinfulness as humans? Is it inherited in some way? Which, of course, to us today, when we say inherited, we often immediately think of something that is transmitted genetically. Or is it a corporate identity? The Bible treats corporate identity very seriously, that we're members of corporate bodies. It's something that the Western world often doesn't, we often don't think that way, but the Bible does, and so do many other cultures. So, or is this just something, as you know, as somebody like Richard Dawkins would argue, this is all just evolutionary remnants of something that helped us survive, and it shouldn't be there anymore, but there it is. All right, if evolution be true, what might be the nature of the fall? Is the fall a metaphor for retained primitive impulses, like I said? Is it some sort of a gradual, incremental loss of innocence that, you know, evil increases compoundly? We certainly often see that in situations, human situations, something small mushrooms over time. Is it some sort of a seed event that then just gradually, you know, had implications work out? is at one, a very, very dramatic degradation of humanity all at one point in time? Or is it something else yet again? And for all of these slides, David has very large bibliographies. There have been many approaches taken, and he's really done his homework going way back into a lot of ideas the church fathers had, people had through the Middle Ages, rabbis have had, and Mishnah commentaries, and many, many different people have been thinking about the first chapters of Genesis for a long time. Okay, so what makes humanity unique? One of the approaches that's being taken is to do genomic analysis to try to see what are the differences in what seem to be the most likely breakpoints between the various great apes, various large primates, and modern humans. And you can see some of those points on there. And by work, now that we can sequence entire genomes, all the DNA sequences of entire species, you can get some idea where are there differences, and kind of work back to what might the last common ancestor have been. It is also, this is extraordinary to me, but it's possible to extract DNA from Neanderthal bones and also some other possible other types of human species like the Denisovans, and to try to see what are differences between the Neanderthals and ourselves and other archaic humans. The one on the, that's a forensic reconstruction. That's a very clever Photoshop that somebody just put up recently. But I bought gas from him once in Kentucky. But anyway, so some of the things that make humans unique are our societal structures, our psychological dynamics. We're very, very social focused, far more so than any other primate. Language per se, that's a topic in itself, but you can debate to what degree some of the advanced mammals have language, but it's nothing like ours. Everybody agrees on that. Religion, technology, art and music, morality, there's just all these breakpoints with other animals, although there are some things that seem analogous, nothing like what humans have. And in addition, we have the ability to begin with a pattern and then make it much more complex, acquire new things, modify things. There's just a creativity and the ability to modify and change that other animals don't have. Some of the unique neurology that's understood now, were David here, he would be very frustrated by the 30 minutes because he could discuss each of these at great length. But one part of the neural differences that seems to be very important is the temporal parietal junction in humans, which based on some studies of skull structure and other archaic hominids, there seems to be space that's been made for this in humans. We also have far more white matter in our brains, which means there's far greater connections, far greater number of possible connections, which is even though you have brains of other mammals like dolphins that are about the same size, we have the ability to do far more computations or thinking or whatever it is we want to use the brains for at the moment than other mammals. All right? And a variety of altered patterns of cerebral expansion based on several lines of evidence, which we won't go into because we've only got half an hour. Humans are different from all the other primates because of the long period of maturation and how the synapses are modified over the course of childhood and well into adolescence. There's increasing appreciation of how synapses that aren't used are just kind of shut down, and new ones are developed, and all sorts of interesting studies done on how that continues well into adulthood. You know, one of the ways to impede dementia and Alzheimer's is to continue to learn new things. We're able to keep making new connections, not as good as when we were kids or teenagers, but you can continue. We have this remarkable ability to learn new things. We have an extended very extended adolescence. perhaps too extended and for some people, but in any case, that is believed to be related to that temporal parietal junction. And something technically known as reentrant circuit dominance, which is a technical way of saying that our brains talk to themselves. And there's a chatter going on all the time. In fact, that many of you know from experience that is one of the things that often impedes prayer. Your mind has just got its own little monologue going on, like the Tonight Show, and you have to get that to quiet down to listen to God, right? You know, we have this, that's reentrant dominance. I added this because I thought it was a good example. This is a famous Far Side cartoon, same planet, different worlds. I wonder if she knows I exist. Should I call her? Maybe she doesn't even know I exist. Well, maybe she does. I'll call her. No, wait. She's thinking, I think I really like vanilla. So anyway, that's reentrant circuit dominance. We have this inner monologue going on in all this. You like that? Same planet, different worlds. The ability to do the genome sequencing has led to other insights. This is taken from a study looking at modifications believed to be due to the transposon ALU. ALU is when it was first discovered. Was in the category of what they call junk DNA. Of course, what a stupid thing to say. Now we know it does really important things. But it's a jumping gene. It's able to move around, and it changes, modifies other genes. That's the executive summary. There's evidence that our genes have been greatly modified from other primates, and in particular permits genetic variation in non-inherited ways, that as you go through life, you can have changes made in some of your genes and gene products as these transposons move around, including affecting your neurons, that is, affecting your brain processes. Very strange stuff. Increased alternate gene splicing and epigenetics would be another topic in itself. Anyway, you got the picture? We ain't apes. Or most of the time. All right. It's difficult to say, though, when all these changes took place based on physical data. In terms of artifacts, there's not a clear breakpoint. You don't suddenly have, rock chips, iPads. All right. Instead, you have, long, very, very, very slow advances in technology, and some of them going way, way back. So whatever all these changes taking place in the neurology, it didn't immediately cause changes in technology, which is kind of curious. Skeletal, you like that? That's a Museum of Natural History in New York. Skeletal changes are also slow compared to the titanic changes that seem to have taken place in our neurology. And a great deal of debate when exactly modern human morphology, when you can draw the line and say this is truly a modern human morphologically and when it's not. The last common ancestor of modern humans and Neanderthals is currently estimated at somewhere around 500,000 years ago. All right. So based on various types of genetic lines of argument, they're particularly looking at some of the haploid forms of the genome, mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome. There is good evidence, and it seems to keep showing up in study after study, that there was some sort of a genetic bottleneck somewhere around 150,000 years ago, perhaps 200,000 years ago, where the modern human population was reduced to a very small number. How small is one of the questions, but relative to other mammals, we have a remarkably small amount of genetic variation. Just think of all the dogs you've met in your life. You just don't meet people that look, express that kind of range of variation. So modern humans began to emigrate out of Africa somewhere 60,000 years or sometime after, all right? And of the humans that went out of Africa, there's evidence for some interbreeding with Neanderthals and perhaps other archaic humans. And maybe 3 to 4% of people descended from people that left Africa. 3 to 4% of the DNA may be from Neanderthals. But basically, this bottleneck population that left Africa. All right, this is the meat of this talk. This is David's model for how we became modern humans. This is before human sin. Increased genetic variability and social selection. We already talked about these various lines of evidence for increased genetic variability with the ALU transposon and so on. With increased stress, you have greater release of the ALU and other transposons. You also have a selection. There's evidence that there was a severe drought in Africa, extended dry conditions in East Africa where modern humans are believed to have come during the height of the last ice age, all right, which is about the time of that bottleneck. So you would have enormous selection for the ability to get food, and also it's conceivable, this is his proposal, that with the stress you would have increased generation of genetic variability because of the greater release of the transposons, okay? And so thus a sustained neurogenetic selection regime. So you're increasing genetic variability and you're also increasing social structures that are advantageous for human survival, joint intentionality, collective intentionality, and a whole number of other themes we could explore. In fact, Dennis is sitting there in the back, and tomorrow is going to talk about some more of this, I think. It's with original sin, and anyway, the evolving apprentice, after he took that term from a man named Sterlini, the high impact of language-based thought and design-directed instruction is one of the things that came out of this with very much of an apprentice, you know, in a sense, lots of animals do apprenticeships. I'm watching some mockingbirds in my backyard apprenticing their babies how to fly. You know, that's kind of directed instruction too. But that's as far as it goes, and the little birds are going to be on their own in about a week. But in the case of humans, with all these changes and this extended adolescence ability to learn, you began to have a social structure where people transmitted a lot of information. There was a great deal of apprenticeship into a culture and so on, so that there was a shift from just genes to neurology to culture, to where the culture also influenced the neurology and the selection of genes. In other words, you have these two forces operating together, both the physical selection of genes and also the culture affecting which genes were selected. Altered selection pressure. All right? All of this meant that you had more ways to transmit information. All right? Bandwidth for information flow. And this is a model indicating how fast you have some sort of a phase change as you increase the number of transmission bandwidth. That's kind of a complicated way to put it. But the idea is that if you just have a very simple way to transmit information, you get a sort of a slow linear change and then a plateauing. Where you have lots of parallel systems, you tend to get a stability for a long time, and then you get kind of like Kuhn's paradigm shift. You get a sudden change, and then that's stable for a long period of time. And so his model, partly how human society began to change, you began to get very stable transmission patterns. You know, that might be one of the reasons why some of these spearhead designs stayed stable for a long time. This is how we make spearheads, all right? You know, you make them this way, not that way. You make them this way, you know. But also that when a change came, it could happen very quickly, all right? So, all right, implications. Gradual genetic accumulation is driven by selection. Sudden functional changes in humanity can be triggered by altered conditions, higher innovation, and social impact, or all three of those at the same time. Altered selective regimes lock in adaptive complexes and absorb outliers. In other words, if you have a cultural pattern that works, you know, people that are on the edges tend to be drawn into that culture. You know, kind of the beginning of empires and cultural assimilation. Social genetic fixation is more likely in isolated groups. So, all right, his proposal on what might have been original sin. You had all these changes taking place in humans, but humans still were sinless. All right? Gradual selective accumulation of human potential stabilized functionally by increasing intense cultural programming of adolescent neural wiring. That's kind of a mouthful, but hopefully what I've gone through that makes sense. You had some sort of environmental and social crisis point that was pushing social and genetic effects. And he postulates that it was at this point that God directly worked with the human race. And he's calling it an interactive divine acculturation. C.S. Lewis proposed something like this long ago in his book, The Problem of Pain, that there were prehumans and God took one or a few or a tribe and worked with them directly so that they could know him and be given a spiritual nature in a way that they hadn't before. That there was, and the acculturation meant that there was some sort of an interaction with God, an apprenticeship from God. That's what the garden is speaking about. You know, that we were apprenticed by God. You know, there was this opportunity and something went awry. So what was it? All right. Divine revelatory activity programmed a new cultural operating system into the brain. The dynamics of the kingdom of God, of altruism, all the things that the Bible talks about that are not natural biological reactions of a mammal. And we rebelled against that. And it was fixed. Now you had a human society that had a potential it didn't have before, but locked into this egoistic rebellion against the apprenticeship by God. And from this point on, you have what he calls a sin acquisition drive, you know, that the culture had been modified. All right, so the resulting modern cultural pattern completely and rapidly displaced the pre-modern cultural complex. All Adam's cultural descendants necessarily are egoistic dominant because that culture determines the neural program that makes us human. Without being nurtured by other humans, you're not human. You know, there are cases of children, you know, left in the woods or something where they never learn to talk and they're never fully human. There's something that's wrong. We have to grow up within a human culture. So the cultural alteration likely altered selection pressures on epigenetic and genetic loci, increasing the power of the pattern. So he says on there, think pit bulls. All dogs can be made to be nasty. You know, maybe even little French poodles, you know, if you beat them enough. But pit bulls have been selected genetically to be fighting dogs. They can also be gentle. But if you have, if you take a pit bull and then, okay, thank you, mistreat it, it's much more likely to respond in that, you know, bad attitude, don't touch me, I'll bite your hand off, type of reason why pit bulls are often dangerous. So, you know, that humans have gradually been pushed in that direction, that the kind of increasing sin culture, because we're nurtured by other sinners. All right, I hope this is making sense. So we're born sinners because we can only become human by being nurtured by sinners. In other words, original sin affected the entire human race and all our culture, and you know, it's a comprehensive problem. Adam's sin is therefore indeed our sin. Adam's sin is embedded in those who make us human, and sadly, we perpetuate it as well. So, all right, we seek sin along with all the other aspects of culture. So it's our corporate identity as sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. The pattern fits and explains the theologians' paradigms for original sin. All that debate, is it Adam's sin? Is it our sin? Is it society's sin? You know, it's, yes. This guy, I mean, yes, it is all those things. All right? And at the very end, he put in this slide, did all death begin with humanity's original sin? He doesn't think so, but in fact, he was working on this one. Well, anyway, he said, I do not pretend to think I've removed all mysteries, nor have I ended all arguments. So I'll pass on that. He has a very extensive bibliography. This is just one of many pages.